Well, what's globalization? That's big. It's a big, big concept. See, globalization, I think, as all the modern theory books will tell us, has been around for a long time. You know, from the time when thousands of years ago people went to trade, when people went to spread the word of Christ or whatever it was. But I think what I see as the problems of globalization today, just to cut a long story short, one is the speed with which there is a economic force that is moving around the world, sort of pulling all diverse local, regional, sub-regional economies into one larger marketplace. And I think that is particularly problematic because it leaves no place for diversity. And by diversity, I mean economic diversity, cultural diversity, social, environmental diversity. It leaves no room for people to be able to determine, or very little room for people to be able to determine how they want to grow their food, where they want to purchase their clothes, how they want to produce, what they consume. And it also imposes a certain blueprint in terms of knowledge systems, skills, what is competence. It homogenizes the world, or it seeks to homogenize the world. And it's all these things that I find tremendously problematic. So there's, but these are at the level of processes that are happening in with globalization and the impacts of globalization. But then there's also then the structural aspects of how this is happening. Who are the actors? Who are the people who are behind this kind of homogenization? And you see, at least I see, that there is a small handful of corporate interests and national government political strategic interests which are linked up with corporate interests. I mean, who serves whose moot point? Is it U.S. corporations who serve the U.S. government, U.S. government who serves the U.S. corporate interests? It goes both ways. And it's not only the U.S., but primarily them, but a lot of other rich countries who are in control of this process. And, more and more, when you compare the whole population of this world and you compare it to this handful of concentrated powers who continue to consolidate their power through buying and acquisition, through controlling agricultural markets, through controlling trade, through controlling pharmaceuticals, through controlling water, land, and the essentials that people live on. For me, that is unacceptable. Ethically and politically, it's unacceptable. I actually don't think that globalization, as we see today, this corporate-led globalization, can be fixed. And I say this because, or maybe I don't understand enough about the larger economic processes or financial processes that push it, So I'm not sure that you can say, let's just open up the TV, redo the circuit, and it's suddenly going to be a better TV. I don't think that will happen with the kind of corporate globalization we have now. I think what we can try to do is arrest it so that space is created for people to develop their alternatives. And I think that's what, at least in the organization I work with, that is focused on the Global South, that's something that we discuss a lot. What does it mean to reverse? Is it possible to reverse this process? When we say deglobalization, what do we mean by that? And I think, the ideas that we think about on this are not only ours. They've come from movements that we work with and activists and researchers, citizens groups, for example, if you look at the agricultural economy, in so many countries, and you will probably hear this from the Indians tomorrow in the panel on financing for development, and you would probably hear it from Thais if they were here, the Thai agricultural movement was here. So often, agricultural workers and producers are being converted to contract producers. They're no longer producing for their own consumption. Many times, people are producing things that they cannot consume at all. Food security now is no longer a matter of self-sufficiency or even being able to be self-reliant. It's a matter of whether you have enough cash, literally cash, to tap into an open market. And I, you know, an alternative to this would be that governments respect the interests of their own producers. And instead of blindly rushing after an international open market, you know, the emphasis is on supporting domestic markets, on strengthening domestic economies, you know, working on redistribution so people who have traditionally not had enough money to buy goods and services can now have money to buy goods and services. Because if they have money to buy goods and services, they will buy goods and services. The rich have everything. So they will not spend that money to buy things that people will produce. I mean, this is just a small example. And I think that's... Maybe it's because I'm not an economist. I don't know. But I think the world is ruled too much by very narrow economistic thinking, in my view. And I think one of the things it does is it alienates people from the knowledge and skills that they have. It alienates people from being able to think for themselves what they want their societies to be. Why is the World Economic Forum sitting there and trying to solve the problems of this world? Why do they think they're able to make that claim? Because there is this accepted, unchallenged assumption that economics will fix it, economics will solve the problem. But it hasn't. I mean, when did the big post-World War II development program start? 1945, 46? Okay, a lot of problems have been solved. There have been great leaps of technology and so on and so forth. But the growing gap, I mean, you know, these are even UNDP statistics. You don't need, I mean, they're not even my original research or something. But almost every major report, international, global, regional, even national report you read about the state of the world will show greater landlessness, more poor people with reduced access to healthcare, more people out of school, more unemployment, casualization of labor. So, but the answer to this is somehow another economic model. And I think I have a problem with that. I cannot accept that. I mean, and if you look at a, you know, if you just take a very, very micro example of, say, a local village economy and see what is the most efficient way to use natural resources, it would be probably very different from what the national economists will tell you. I think one of the early things to try and have an alternative economic model is to accept that economics is not the king of all the knowledges. It's not the king of all the sciences. It doesn't actually, I mean, and it should not be allowed to rule the way policies are developed. I think issues of social solidarity, issues of strengthening societies and communities, capacities by which in times of crisis people can help each other and so on and so forth. I mean, those are things that, or those are, I guess, efforts or policies that can actually be much more economic in the long term. Because then you don't erode away the foundation of a society to survive. And it is at that level that diversity is so particularly important. And it's at that level that, you know, the more skills society has, the more diverse its economic base will be. And the more diverse its economic base will be, you know, the stronger it will be to withstand shocks, whether it's from inside or outside, whether it's an earthquake, a natural calamity, or whether it's an economic crisis of some kind, or a war. And I think that means much more power in the hands of people. Much more popular, really, I guess I use the word democracy because I don't know what other word to use, but really popular democracy, where democracy is not just about casting a vote, but it's about interests being negotiated. And maybe direct democracy, to go back to the Athenian sense or whatever the Grecian sense, is, yeah, maybe that's not possible. But I think given the kind of world we live in, within each country, it is possible for citizens to have much more direct input into how the policies that their government makes responds to their interests and their needs. Because if you have a diverse society, you're always going to have a negotiated You're always going to have a negotiated interest base. It's not going to be any other way. But that's what makes a society dynamic. But now, what we have is we have many countries which have democracy, quote unquote. But what does that mean? It means that people who have, by and large, been entrenched as elites, you know, who have traditionally always had political, who've had political and economic advantage. In India, from the upper castes, maybe in Thailand, they're the landed elite. In the Philippines, you know, the people who've been rich and powerful will be the ones who will, who will make the campaigns for power, who will stand for elections, who will, you know, go for local or national or regional office. And who are these people? What is their cultural base? What is their social base? Whose interests will they serve? And eventually, yes, you will have maybe hundreds of thousands of poor farmers who will go and cast a vote. But that doesn't mean that they're actually going to be able to reverse, you know, projects that take away their land, which convert, you know, mountain slopes into plantations, or which convert, small-scale fisheries into large aquaculture situations. So, I mean, I think from the political side, I think I would argue for much more localization. Yes, but I think the political power, the interesting thing is that the political power that we're talking about globally, we're not talking about a political power alone. We're talking about, you know, a diversity. I think what we have here in the World Social Forum and among all the movements and activists here is common goals, common critiques. But one of the activists in our panel today pointed out, when you listen to what happens in the world, sure, you see that all the problems are the same. But the way it would be handled in the state of Andhra Pradesh in India, and the way it will be addressed and challenged in Northeast Thailand, and the way it would be challenged in, you know, Pakistan or Egypt, would be different. So yes, I mean, we do have a common political ambition and goal. But I think the strategies will be different. The strategies will be social, culturally, and local politics based. These kinds of fora where people are coming together are an excellent example of how politics is becoming more, what I would call popular, more local, I guess. But I don't know if local is a loaded loaded term.
Yes, but because we are coming from all...
No.
Maybe isn't it not... The thing could be, you need to be free to do your own political will at the local level.
Yes.
You need to unite on the global level to have this freedom for everyone, locally.
Yeah, a new internationalism. I mean, you can argue for local, subnational, and national autonomy without cutting yourself off. You know, and I think that's what globalization, the way we see it, corporate globalization now, does not allow. It's one size fits all. Be with us or be behind. And you don't even have a choice, really. You know, you don't even have a choice of be with us or not, because the decisions that are being made at national, regional, international levels don't leave people to exercise this agency. You know, I think the very fact that this is a World Social Forum already shows that there is a success intellectually and in the conceptualization of what we want in a future world. That people are getting together, thousands of people are getting together to conceptualize a future world or strategies and alternatives that put society and that put social priorities at the center. So I think that is already a success, you know, in one way. When I look around me and I see, and I'm filled in a room with people from speak all these different languages, no matter how chaotic it is, yeah? And you have people from one end of the world and another person from another end of the world, and they are able to speak through translators and are able to share experiences and maybe put out a global call, maybe not, but at least they go away heartened saying, we're not alone. I think that's already another measure of success. I think in general, the whole effort bringing together people and so on and so forth is already something that I would consider a big benchmark. But maybe by the end of the conference, if something a little more concrete comes out, Of course, there would be declarations, but more initiatives. I think if I can hear of, okay, people around land rights got together and launched a campaign or launched another alliance together, I think that I would see as a real concrete measure of success. If people agree that we try to do this every 2 years, no matter how difficult, and we move it around the world, this year in Brazil, maybe another 2 years in Southeast Asia somewhere, maybe then in North Africa, you know, I think that would be another measure of success, because it will snowball. There are a lot of disadvantaged people. There are a lot of unhappy people in the world, but there are also a lot of people with a lot of skills, capacities, and power. And, you know, I think it will snowball. I think as people realize that it's not all doom and gloom, that we can make a difference, people will come. People will join hands in this. Well, the workshop was on land rights, natural resources, and the development paradigm. And it's really at the level of the natural resource economy that you see the tremendous failings of the neoclassical economic model and the model that drives economic globalization as we see it today. And it's, I think, personally for myself and for a number of other activists I work with, it's because so many of us have worked with movements like this that we find it so very hard to accept these narrow notions of efficiency, you know, in a certain way of using resources to feed, this sort of greedy, guzzling, you know, economic model. And I think a lot of the proposals that were coming out or the points that were being made were ways to confront and counteract the moves that consolidate this kind of mainstream, more dominant development model. So one is to actually... One idea that came out from everybody was that we have to find a way to constantly oppose and challenge the commodification of land and resources, natural resources. You know, land, water, forests are for so that people can live and survive. They're so that people have... It's to recognize that people have a right to grow their own food, people have a right to produce their own things, and people have a right to consume what they produce. They should not be forced to use their assets that they have, or the assets that they have struggled, you know, over many kinds of disadvantages. They should not have to sell that or put that up as collateral to banks and so on and so forth. You know, they should be able to do with it what can give them the most maximum social and community level security. And so, you know, to challenge commodification of land and resources is a big one. Another one is to challenge the way the major international financial institutions, particularly the World Bank, is taking the rhetoric of redistribution, progressive redistribution, land reform. They use the word land reform, which is, you know, the term that progressive change agents have used, and they now use it. And their way of doing it is to put land as a market commodity. So to challenge that, and to say stop, there are some things that cannot move into the market. You do not put natural resources that the foundation of life depends on, you do not put it on the market. Because then what you put on the market is people's survival capacity, which is already there, unfortunately, on the market, but this is a way to arrest that and to subvert it. Another is people argue for people's action. Don't wait for the government to come and help you. Don't wait for some other agency to come and help you. If you have been disenfranchised from your resource, claim it. Go and take it. Occupy land. Show that you can work land in a way that will make it yield, productivity or production or goods, services that you need, you know. So there was that, you know, this whole thing of, I don't know, you were there, but people...
At the end.
Reclaim land. Go and occupy it, and then push local national policymakers to then enact, force them to develop policies and laws that respond to your interests. I mean, to the interests of its own people, not to the interests of transnational corporations or for paying off debts that were illegitimately incurred most of the time anyway. Another one was to do whatever we can to fight historic inequities from culture, the point of view of culture, economics, gender, class, race, and new kinds of inequities that are coming up when people, you know, use whatever assets that they have into a sort of a share market and put up the land for collateral or whatever, and then they lose it. But in many places, if you look at what's happened with land and landlessness, people who don't have access to land or who don't own land have been historically discriminated against for one reason or another, either because of a caste system as in India, because of race as in many parts of Africa, because of religion. Minority groups have not been allowed the same access to land and productive resources as majority groups. And no matter how much the world has changed, that historical inequity has in many places been entrenched. And within many, many societies, for example, women will work the land. Women do as much, if not more, work on the land than men do, but they're not allowed ownership of land. And the whole issue of feminization of poverty has a lot to do with women's abilities in many, many cultures, I'm not saying everywhere, but in many cultures, to be able to overcome this hurdle. You know, do they actually have legal protection over resources? This would be a very difficult, historical inequity to overcome. Because, gender politics divide families, they divide communities, they divide nations, they divide movements. Very often, people within a movement will say, by bringing in the gender dimension, you divide the movement, you fracture the movement. But I think, I'm not sure that that's what feminist activists are necessarily asking for. They're not asking to divide a movement. What they're asking is for sensitivity that, gender, class, race, culture are all factors that come into the creation of haves and have-nots, or those who have, in the way power is played out. So, that point was discussed. This issue was discussed quite a bit in the early part of the workshop. We were just talking about gender being culture. Yes, gender is culture. Gender is also economic. It's also material. It's also social. But I think that's the thing about culture. Culture is all these things. Culture in it has an economic aspect, it has a social aspect, it has a political aspect. And I think that's another reason why I reject this kind of economistic thinking by which seems to pervade the world, that economy is economy, social stuff is social stuff, culture is culture. Culture is another separate category. It is not. Culture is the way people, communities, societies relate with their environment, whatever their environment is. It's the way they, the knowledge base is based in something and that develops out of culture. It's a living thing. And that is why forest management systems, saving groups, agricultural production systems vary so widely. It's because of culture. It's because of belief systems. It's because of the kinds of values that people put on these, different processes and exchange systems that they have, production and exchange systems. And I think to somehow talk about gender, as often happens among mainstream policy reformers, without actually looking at the material basis of what in the culture creates gender relations, what determines the power relations between men and women, what determines power relations between classes, that's actually much more obvious. But what has been that history? Without actually looking at that and bringing the two together, you will end up with more women in development programs, more rice mills, more water things, more. And I'm not saying that those interventions are not important, but they're absolutely insufficient. And on their own, they can be quite dangerous because they will divide society and they will create a false consensus that, now the gender problem is solved. But it's not, it's much more complex.